Hello, thank you for inviting me and having me here. I have to apologize for my voice. I'm recovering from a bit of a cold, so a little bit more scratchy than normal here. But today I'm going to survey the exciting field of exoplanets and not just treating them as dots in the sky, but actually trying to learn about them as worlds, especially focusing on an area that I like a lot, which is the atmospheric circulation. First, I'm going to give a broad overview of what we know about exoplanets, and then I will focus on a specific dynamical problem of interest. Exoplanets is an exploding new field. This is a broad audience, I've been told, so I'm not aiming this just for the folks in this field. There's over almost 540 known extrasolar planets as of this time, which is pretty amazing if you think about it. So you have, sort of a factor of 60, 50, 60 more planets discovered outside of our solar system that are known in it. Most of these are discovered with the so-called Doppler method, whereby you don't directly detect the planet, but the planet, of course, is orbiting about the center of mass of the planet-star system, causes the star to wobble back and forth. There's a Doppler signature, and we can detect the component of the motion toward our line of sight or away from our line of sight from the Doppler shift, down to pretty sensitive levels that allow detection of planets. And in addition to that, there are other detection methods. If you discover planets with this Doppler method, you get a lower limit on the mass of the planet. It's a lower limit because you don't know the inclination of the planet's orbit. If you knew the planet was in the line of sight to Earth, it would give you the actual mass. But the projected component of the motion toward Earth would be the same for a more massive planet that had a solar system plane that was inclined relative to the line of sight to Earth. You also get the orbital properties, such as the orbital period, semi-major axis, and the orbital eccentricity. Another method that's proved very useful is the so-called transit method. In general, we might expect the planes of other solar systems to be randomly aligned with respect to the line of sight to Earth. But if you get lucky, then a solar system will lie in the same plane as the line of sight to Earth. And in that case, the planet will pass in front of its star once per orbit. And in that case, even though you can't see, you can't resolve the planet or the star, the planet is passing in front of the star, and as a result, there's a drop in the combined light from the planet-star system. A Jupiter-like planet is roughly a tenth of the solar radius, and so as a result, blocks 1% of the solar disk. So you see a 1% drop in the total flux coming from the system. That is very easy to detect, even from the ground with sort of 30-centimeter telescopes at high enough signal-to-noise in order to be able to discover these planets. If you do this in a very, very precise way from the Hubble Space Telescope or other future platforms, you can actually infer the atmospheric composition. The way this happens is that, take this planet and imagine that there are some rays of light that are just smacking into the backside of the planet and never reaching Earth. There are some rays of planet emanating from over here, say, that just go straight to Earth. And there are some rays of light that pass tangentially through the planet's atmosphere. And at wavelengths where the planet's atmosphere absorbs, those rays of light will be preferentially blocked, whereas at wavelengths that are where the atmosphere of the planet is transparent, those rays will pass on through. As a result, the effective radius of the planet is a function of wavelength, and that effectively gives you a transmission spectrum, an absorption spectrum. This shows an example. This is a plot in wavelengths from Eagle et al. From visible up through kind of mid-infrared, 10, 20, 30 microns. And the red line is a model, and then the blue crosses are data points from a variety of sources. And what's shown on the y-axis is the absorption in percent. So this is the fraction of the star's disk, effectively, that's being blocked by the planet. So up means that the planet is effectively larger, which means this is a wavelength where more absorption is occurring. So high on this plot is an absorption feature. And you can see that there's a lot of structure. And a model of this would suggest that there is water vapor in this planet's atmosphere. There's a feature that has been suggested to be due to methane, et cetera. So one can, from this, infer composition. And a few exoplanets, there's actually been the suggestion of the existence of water and carbon monoxide and other gas trace species in addition to the background hydrogen. I might mention this is actually a contentious issue. There are several groups who do not agree at this point, so this is not converged yet. But this is a powerful method that will be very useful in the future. I might also mention that most of these planets, because of this, we know are roughly Jupiter in radius, and as a result, we know they're mostly hydrogen. So a planet that has Jupiter's mass and radius can only be made mostly of hydrogen. If it were made of anything else and it were Jupiter mass, it would be significantly smaller than Jupiter. Just to give a sense of the pace of the field, the top two plots show discoveries versus year of discovery. So, you know, this is 1988, 1990, 2000, up through 2011. And this is showing the planet mass. So each dot is a discovery and shows the mass of the planet. And this shows the radius of the planet. So these discoveries are through the Doppler method, and these are through the transit method. And you can see that initially, for the most part, the planets that are being discovered were massive. And of course, that's because those planets tug on the star harder and produce a larger signal, Doppler signal. And as the methods have been revised and refined over time, the envelope for the planets that can be discovered is getting to smaller and smaller masses. We're still discovering planets that are massive. That's because, you know, say, there's also a timeline issue. Saturn, for example, takes 30 years to orbit the sun, and you can't detect a planet to Saturn's distance unless you have observed for something approaching 30 years so that you can capture a whole orbit. So because of that effect, we're continuing to discover planets that are massive further and further from the stars, but we're also pushing this mass envelope where we're almost getting to the point of being able to detect an Earth mass planet. So this is one Jupiter mass, 10 Jupiter masses, 1/100 and 1/1000th of a Jupiter mass. An Earth mass is right here, 318 Earth masses is one Jupiter. So we are literally sort of this year on the verge of discovering Earth's mass planets. And then likewise with transit, you can most easily discover planets that have Jupiter-like radii. This is a linear scale in this case, from 0 to 2 Jupiter radii. Most of the planets are scattered widely around one Jupiter radius. But again, we're slowly pushing the envelope and discovering smaller and smaller planets. And one Earth radius planet is about 0.1 on the scale. So these planets are just about Earth radius here. So we're literally on the verge right now of discovering Earth mass and Earth-sized planets. This shows a sort of phase-space diagram of the semi-major axis versus the mass of the planet. And so you can see the planets clustered here. These are in different techniques. The planets that are very far, and just for those who don't know, an AU stands for astronomical unit, which is one Earth-Sun distance. So Pluto is at 40 AU, for example. So these planets are at hundreds of AU. These are detected through direct imaging, hot young planets that are so far from their stars that we can directly image them. These planets in here are all discovered with the Doppler technique, and these guys are detected with the transit technique. And a point that I want to make is that many of these planets are very, very close to their stars, which is largely due to the biases of these two methods of discovery that I've mentioned. And so even though, you know, many solar systems may lack planets that are very, very close in, there are indeed many solar systems where there are planets that are at 0.2, 0.1, even 0.05 or less astronomical units from their stars. So 20 or 30 times closer to their stars than Earth is to the sun. As a result, these planets are absolutely blasted by starlight, and we think they are in a regime where their interiors are at or near close to a synchronous rotation state, where they rotate once per orbital period like the Earth's moon does around the Earth. If you think about the geometry of a transit event, so the planet passes in front of the star, and half an orbit later, it passes behind the star. And from that, you can get information on the infrared flux coming from the planet. This shows a detection of both of those events from the Spitzer Space Telescope in an Earth-trailing orbit at 8 microns Heather Knudsen et al., 2007. So this is the relative flux of the system at 8 microns in a broadband pass. And the top plot is combined light from the planet-star system. We're not separately resolving the planet. And this refers to the transit. The planet passes in front of a star, so the total light drops by 2%. So we're blocking 2% of the stellar disk. A few hours later, that ends. Half an orbit later, there's another drop. And this second drop, so-called secondary eclipse, is when the planet passes behind the star. The fact that this event exists means that this planet is radiating flux in the infrared. Because if it were not, you would not have this feature. As a result, from knowing the radius of the planet from the transit measurements, we can then use that and use the observation of this dip, size of this dip, to infer the brightness temperature at this wavelength for this planet on the day side. If you think about the geometry, the night side of the planet is facing Earth at this point in time. That's when the planet is passing in front of the stellar disk. Half an orbit later, the day side of the planet is aimed toward Earth. If you take this same plot and you blow it up and just see the detail in the structure, you can see that there actually is structure. The curve is not flat in between these two events. This is as the night side is sitting in view of Earth and then is rotating out of view, and the day side is rotating into view. And so this flux increase has been interpreted as a signature of a day-night temperature difference. The night side is colder, the day side is hotter, and as a result, you see this uplift. If there were no atmospheric dynamics on this planet, the hottest point would be the substellar point, the region of high noon. And that is facing Earth immediately before and after the secondary eclipse event. There is a suggestion, though, that this peak is actually preceding that secondary eclipse by several hours. And if you think about the geometry, that actually means that the hottest point in this wavelength is not at the substellar point, which is marked by the central meridian on this plot, but is actually shifted eastward by several tens of degrees in longitude. So you can actually do sort of a crude inversion on this to make a map of what the brightness temperature or flux is at this wavelength versus longitude, and this is what you get. And then you can do the same thing, a whole same story at 24 microns, and there's more scatter in the data, but if you bin it up, you see exactly the same story. So the secondary eclipse on both of these plots is at 0.5, and you can see the flux peaks before that. So this is a signature of meteorology in the planet's atmosphere. There's other examples of light curves from hot Jupiters. This is some examples from the last few years. There's a number of other examples that are being done now that are not yet published that are quite exciting that will come out in the next couple of years. And there's a wide range of behaviors. Maybe I should mention, in addition to the offset itself, another interesting feature is the amplitude. So this is, the depth of the secondary eclipse is a signature of the total amount of flux coming from the day side of the planet. So if the night side were not radiating, this sinusoid would start at the dashed line and it would go up to there. This dashed line is the star alone, which is all you're seeing during the secondary eclipse. The fact that this signature is only one-third of that depth means that the night side is cooler, but not that much cooler than the day side. If you model this in detail, you have a day side brightness temperature of about 1,200 Kelvin and a night side brightness temperature of about 1,000. So you have a day-night temperature difference of 200 K, or about 15 to 20%, which is not that huge if this is a tidally locked planet. There are other cases where the day-night temperature difference may be significantly larger, including some unpublished cases, which are quite spectacular. And as a whole, this suggests a wide range of behaviors. In addition to looking at offsets, you can actually plot some of these data up. If you simply plot the ratio of the phase amplitude versus the occultation depth, so this is that same ratio with the planet I showed you earlier being at a third, then you get this plot for different planets. So the light curve that I explained in detail is this planet with two different wavelengths showing up here. This planet, this axis shows, is a measure essentially how much flux the planet's getting from the star. It's the effective temperature of the planet if it were in thermal balance with the star with a zero albedo. And so some planets that are hot but not that hot seem to have a modest phase amplitude, whereas planets that are very, very hot seem to have a bigger fractional day-night temperature difference. So there may well be a shift in regimes that's going on here that raises a number of fundamental questions about how atmospheres behave. I might mention that in the case of Earth's atmosphere, in the tropics, for example, the interaction of waves with the large-scale flow tends to homogenize the temperature. So the temperatures in the tropics are very, very homogenized, which is a property that sort of, cast in an approximation in atmospheric dynamics called the weak temperature gradient approximation. It would appear that that is breaking down in the regime of hot Jupiters. So the radiation is so strong, the radiative time constants are so short in these cases, that we're shifting regimes to one where the normal processes that homogenize temperatures on a planet are not operating well anymore, and you're producing gigantic day-night temperature differences. This, in turn, raises a number of interesting questions about whether these planets would have jets. If you're damping out the waves that are homogenizing the temperature, maybe you're also damping out the waves that tend to pump the jet streams in planetary atmospheres. So we may well have a very sort of significant regime shift in these planetary atmospheres. And one could imagine actually modeling this in detail. If you could get circulation models that you can imagine turning on or off various processes and then doing a bunch of runs to scan this behavior and comparing the statistics of these kinds of plots to those outputs in order to get a statistical sense of whether various kinds of processes are operating in this planetary atmosphere. So the error bars on some of these points are large as yet, so that probably wouldn't work with this current data set. But over the next 10 years, we're going to get a lot more points with much smaller error bars, and that'll probably start working. So these kinds of statistical studies are going to be very useful. Okay, why do we study the circulation? Hopefully I convinced you that there actually is some data that constrains the circulation. And maybe I should emphasize that many exoplanets are going to be in dynamically unusual regimes that do not exist in our solar system. So an example is these gas giants, these hot Jupiters that are on very close in orbits and are blasted by starlight that's thousands of times stronger than what Earth gets and tens to hundreds of thousands of times stronger than what Jupiter gets from the sun. They're also slowly rotating, we think. There are many planets that are on highly eccentric orbits where you have an order of magnitude or more variation in the starlight throughout the orbit and so on. So studying these planets broadens our understanding of meteorology, climate, and in the case of terrestrial planets, planetary habitability. Circulation, as I've shown, also shapes observations, infrared spectra, light curves, of course, affects the cloudiness, which affects the albedo. They can even affect the evolution through atmosphere-interior interactions and climate and chemistry. And so to explain these, we want to understand the circulation. Existing spectra and light curves that we have are already challenged our understanding, and there's going to be sort of explosion of new data over the next couple decades. For example, the Spitzer Space Telescope that I alluded to, in its early phase, had a wide range of wavelengths extending out to the far infrared, and there are, of course, many fields competing for that data, including cosmology. I see somebody nodding his head there, you know. Well, now the cryogens run out. There's only a couple short wavelengths left, so a lot of folks who wanted to study what's going on at 30 microns are left high and dry. But the short wavelengths are actually where the flux peaks for these hot Jupiters. So the shortest wavelengths that are still available are great. And they're giving exoplanets gobs and gobs of time now because there's a lot of other subjects that can't be studied anymore. Most of that data has not yet been published. So there's a gigantic amount coming on the horizon. And then we have JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is sort of the Uber Spitzer for another 5 or 10 years hence. There's also the Kepler NASA mission going on. There's a lot of things going on. Also, there's been a revolution in detecting secondary eclipses from the ground, which was not expected initially, but there's been many new, very interesting constraints coming from ground-based telescopic work. Just to follow up on the first point, exoplanets, even in absence of comparisons with data, exoplanets raise many fundamental questions concerning the mechanisms that control atmospheres generally, the mean climate, the geometry and speed of the winds, the mechanisms that control the circulation, the day-night or equator-to-pole temperature differences, the long-term evolution, both for terrestrial planets and gas giants, and, of course, for terrestrial planets, the habitability. And so just the raising of these questions is a useful exercise, and there's a hope that we actually might be able to learn some concrete things about these questions in the next decade or two with the combination of new observations and new modeling. Okay, so the specific motivation for the talk I'm going to present here, the work I'm going to present here, is to see if we can explain some of the light curves that I mentioned, that I showed for that first planet that I alluded to, and then also to study the fundamental dynamics of this novel circulation regime, to understand how it's similar or different to that on solar system planets. Are we dealing with the same circulation regime with just slightly different parameter settings, or is this a fundamentally different regime that we have in the solar system? That's a question to answer. And likewise, how do the dynamics depend generally on the planetary rotation rate, stellar radiation, atmospheric metallicity, which just means the composition? Are there multiple dynamical regimes? And if so, what governs them? And what are the implications for observations? Let me also briefly mention what happens in the atmospheres of the giant planets in our solar system, because that's sort of the ground truth for hot Jupiters. They're in a different dynamical regime, but as far as giant planets, this is kind of what we've got to work with. So Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, visible wavelength images, these are shown to scale. You're looking at clouds in all cases. By tracking the clouds, you can get a sense of what the winds are. And this shows the winds for Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Wind speed on the x-axis and latitude in each case on the y-axis. Uranus and Neptune have very broad wind patterns with sort of eastward high-latitude jets and a broad westward or sub-rotating jet at the equator. Jupiter and Saturn have numerous jets. These wiggles are not noise. They're actual jet structure with alternating eastward and westward flows and then broad equatorial jets. Also notice that Jupiter and Saturn's flow at the equator is going to the east, whereas that on Uranus and Neptune is going to the west. This is termed atmospheric superrotation in the terrestrial dynamics literature. And it's a very interesting phenomenon because the equator at the surface of a planet is the point of the planet that's farthest from the planetary rotation axis. So if you have a circulation that conserves the angular momentum or is axisymmetric about the rotation axis, then that type of a circulation, if you imagine moving fluid from either deep inside the planet or high latitudes to the equator, you're increasing the lever arm and you will produce westward flow. That happens in the Hadley cell on the Earth and is the basic reason why the tropical tropospheric winds on the Earth blow westward. So clearly that is not happening on Jupiter and Saturn. So you have to pump momentum to produce this feature, which is a local maximum of angular momentum per mass about the rotation axis. You have to pump angular momentum from regions where it's low to regions where it's high. And of course, this is a classic thing that turbulence can do, but the details in this case are what are the specific mechanisms, why does it occur on Jupiter and Saturn and not on Uranus and Neptune, and then also we'd like to know, would this occur on hot Jupiters and other exoplanets, which regime would they be in? Just to illustrate very briefly what's happening in the state of the art for Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, We're still, in many ways, even for our own giant planets, trying to understand the zeroth order circulation regime. The level of detail of the modeling is still very different from that currently being done in the Earth climate field. But still, the models are starting to have some fidelity as far as reproducing the basic regime. This shows an example from a graduate student of mine who finished about a year ago. And this shows model three-dimensional sort of shallow atmosphere models where we include latent heating and then included the condensation of, and understand how the regions of latent heating interact with the large-scale flow. And what you end up getting, and so all the only parameters that are varied, this is one numerical integration for Jupiter, one for Saturn, and one case that represents Uranus and Neptune. And the only thing that's varied in these three numerical integrations are the planetary parameters like rotation rate and radius, and then also the amount of water. And we varied the amount of water based on what we think exists on these planets. And for the Jupiter and Saturn regime, you can actually get multiple bands. If you look down over the North Pole, you can see alternating eastward-westward, eastward jets. And then this is showing the mean east-west wind speed in meters a second in all cases. So red is eastward, yellow is weakly eastward, blue is westward. And then you have a fast eastward jet at the equator on Jupiter and Saturn. And Uranus and Neptune, you get very high latitude eastward jets and then a broad sub-rotating jet at the equator. So this is actually the first model that has within the context of a single mechanism or a single model has produced both regimes of behavior. So hopefully if we apply the analogous dynamical model to hot Jupiter, we could at least not feel like we're completely fooling ourselves. Okay, what's the dynamical regime of a hot Jupiter and how's it different than Jupiter? We think the circulation is driven primarily by the global scale heating contrast of of order 10 to the 5 watts per square meter on the day side and comparable amount of IR cooling on the night side. If the rotation is synchronous, then for typical 1 to 10 day orbital periods, we expect the Coriolis forces to be important but not dominant. Rossby numbers of order unity, in other words. Another important point is that evolution models, which I have myself not done, but others in the field have, suggest that these planets have very deep stratified layers. The radiative convective boundary is not where the planet is radiating to space. It's at hundreds of bars or even 1,000 bars. This shows a bunch of evolution models from Jonathan Fortney's paper in 2007. The cases on the left are, each one of these is a temperature profile run over a solar system history for hypothetical Jupiter-like planets at different distances from their stars given an AU. So 10 AU, 5 AU, Jupiter itself is at 5 AU, 1 AU, so this would be at an Earth-like distance, and these are hot Jupiters here. And the thick part of the curve shows the region that's convecting. So these cases like Jupiter and Saturn are convecting all the way up to the top almost, and then you have a stratosphere. However, when you have a hot Jupiter that's blasted by starlight, it pushes the radiative convective boundary down to hundreds or even thousands of bars. So you should remember that any weather that we're sensing with observations is not weather in a convection zone. It's weather in a stratified, rotating, turbulent fluid, just like in the case of the Earth. Timescale arguments, if one makes estimates of wind speeds and then compares that to kind of dynamical times to transport the wind across a hemisphere or to transport waves across a hemisphere, then one can expect that at pressures less than maybe a bar to a tenth of a bar, the radiative times will be shorter than that for typical hot Jupiter, so you might get large temperature contrasts at low pressures, whereas the reverse is true deeper, and so below some depth, then the temperatures will be more constant on isobars. Okay, so what controls the shape and size of flow structures in these types of atmospheres? There's two fundamental length scales. One is the so-called deformation radius, Rossby deformation radius. This is basically the speed of buoyancy waves or gravity waves, c, it's a horizontal propagation speed, divided by omega, the rotation rate. This is a length scale and is a natural scale for vortex formation and flow instability. So this is the length scale that determines the eddies in the mid-latitudes that cause that determine the length of fronts, for example, on the Earth. The Rhine's length is another length scale, which is the mean wind speed, square root of the mean wind speed over this quantity beta, where beta is basically the gradient of how the rate of change of the strength of the Coriolis force with latitude. And it turns out that it's that gradient that produces anisotropy in atmospheres. And so, if the planet, if you have just a rotating tank experiment where there's no, gradient in a laboratory scale, for example, if there's no such gradient, you can produce vortices, but you don't tend to produce jets. Whereas when this length scale is small compared to the size of the domain, then the flow organizes into jets. On Jupiter and Saturn, these length scales are much less than a planetary radius. They're, maybe between 3 and 10% of the planetary radius. And that helps explain why Jupiter and Saturn are broken up into numerous bands and jets. And interestingly, on Jupiter, you can see this anisotropy, the scale-dependent anisotropy in action with this kind of a picture. This is an infrared image from Cassini of Jupiter at 5-micron wavelength. You're looking at infrared emissions, so the dark regions are cloud-covered spots. And you can see at very short length scales, the blobs are quasi-circular, so it's quasi-isotropic on scales less than 1,000 kilometers. But at scales of kind of 5 or 10,000 kilometers and more, the flow is banded. And that's reflecting the break in the behavior at this Rhines length, with isotropic behavior below that, horizontally isotropic, and anisotropic behavior above that. On hot Jupiters, the rotation rate is slower, the thing is more stratified, the gravity wave speeds are faster, wind speeds are probably faster, and if you make estimates of these length scales for hot Jupiters, they're much closer to a planetary radius. So we expect the flow on hot Jupiters to be much more kind of global in scale than is the case on Jupiter. And that's backed up, actually, by calculations. Okay, so I'm going to briefly show some three-dimensional atmospheric models and illustrate a few also from my own group, and then illustrate some comparable results from other groups, and then spend the rest of the talk trying to explain one of the dynamical features that seems to be fairly ubiquitous in that class of models. So in this case, I solved the full nonlinear equations of motion, the so-called primitive equations of meteorology. This is a subset of the Navier-Stokes equations that are used in atmospheres when the vertical scales are much, much smaller than the horizontal scales, which is generally true in atmospheres, using the MIT GCM, which is a state-of-the-art GCM. And we connected this to radiative transfer to drive the heating and cooling and drive the circulation. So this is the plane parallel multi-stream model from Mark Marley and Chris McKay, which has been used by Mark Marley and Jonathan Fortney over the last 15 years for brown dwarfs and for hot Jupiters. This has mostly previously been used in a 1D mode, state-of-the-art model, and here we've coupled it to this to produce sort of a crude, quote, GCM, general circulation model for a hot Jupiter. We're at the moment ignoring clouds, and we choose a composition scaled to what we think Jupiter or the other planets in our solar system have, and for the moment we're simply assuming that the chemistry is equilibrium. Determine the heating rate from just the vertical divergence of the vertical radiative flux, go from atmospheres significantly above where radiation escapes to space down to hundreds of bars near the radiative convective boundary, and generally assume that the planet is synchronously rotating, although we've varied this assumption in a number of cases. And the cases that I'll show here focus on this planet HD189733b, which is the planet that had those really nice light curves that I showed at the beginning. This shows an example of the circulation field from this. So each of these panels shows the temperature field versus longitude on the x-axis and latitude on the y-axis. So the equator is here in the middle. The center of the plot is the substellar point. So these are assumed to be synchronous. So the whole middle of the plot, one terminator is right here. The other terminator is there. So this whole middle part of the plot is the day side, and that's always the day side, right? Because we're assuming it's synchronously locked. This strip and this strip are the night side, and this point is the antistellar point. This shows deep in the atmosphere at a bar and a fraction of a bar and a tiny fraction of a bar, showing the vertical structure. And what develops, and I've put these sort of large arrows on here to schematically illustrate, those little arrows are maybe hard to see, first of all, you can see that the flow is very broad, as we expected from scaling arguments. So, you know, the width of the jets is kind of roughly similar to the planetary radius. And then you get this very fast equatorial superrotation across all these model levels. And it turns out that so this shows this light curve for this planet in 8 microns. And as I alluded to at the beginning, if there were no offset, so you can see here that if I back up for a second, there's this offset where the hottest regions are occurring eastward of the substellar point, analogous to what I alluded to in the observations. And so you can actually calculate light curves from these models and compare them to the observations, and this is what you get for one composition and for a different composition. Details are different, but the basic picture is the same. So the different colors are showing data at different wavelengths. So this is the 24-micron wavelength, 8-micron wavelength, and there's just some other points at different wavelengths at certain localized times. And to zeroth order, we're not doing too bad. I mean, there are certain features. This hook may not be real in the data, actually. There's some problems with the analysis right at the beginning of the trajectory. But we're getting to zeroth order the day-night temperature or day-night flux contrast on this object, and we're getting this offset where the flux peak precedes the secondary eclipse. In this case, we're over-predicting it. But, you know, we're at least sort of in the right ballpark, perhaps. One can also predict compare the photometry, sort of a crude spectrum, with what this model predicts. And we're doing fine except for one wavelength where there's problems for a number of objects, including brown dwarfs, that are not understood at that wavelength. Let me just now talk about dynamics. So there's a number of groups that have been doing these kinds of 3D models, and starting with Shoman and Guillot in 2002. And almost all of these models produce this kind of equatorial superrotation that I alluded to. So this was a very crude model from the point of view of radiative transfer. We're not very sophisticated at that point. But the dynamics was good. And we produced this superrotation, which caused this offset of this hot point, analogous to what was then observed 5 years later. And you can see that there's a number of other groups that have done this, and they all get basically the same thing. So these plots, again, show temperature with winds as arrows, all with the substellar point being in the center of the plot. This particular plot, the color is showing actually the wind speed. So red here means the superrotating jet. And it's all basically, the details are different about whether the jet wiggles or not, but the basic picture is the same in all of these cases. And the fact that there's possibly a hint of superrotation on this planet in the form of this shifted hotspot, and the fact that we have a number of different groups now agreeing on this phenomenon suggests that this phenomenon is worth understanding. So what I've now done is try to understand the mechanisms for this in detail. It turns out there's a number of Earth papers, actually, that stumbled upon a similar phenomenon. Earth is mostly driven at large scales by the equator to pole difference in heating. So there's net heating at the equator, net cooling at the poles. And so you have a Hadley cell at low latitudes, and you get jets at high latitudes. But it turns out that if you stick in tropical heat sources that vary in longitude, with heating at some longitudes and cooling at the others, perhaps representing higher sea surface temperatures in the western Pacific than the eastern Pacific, and that causes a gradient in the amount of tropospheric heating due to cumulus convection, for example. If that's strong enough in the model, then even these Earth circulation models transition into a regime where you get superrotation. So we have this basic commonality where all these models that are strongly driven by zonal variations in heating at the equator produce superrotation. Even in the Earth literature, this is not well understood. The current Earth is not in that regime, so that's a bit of a, it's not so relevant for climate change, for example. Okay, so what causes the equatorial superrotation? There's a fundamental theorem due to Hyde, which I alluded to earlier, that you cannot get a superrotating jet from an axisymmetric circulation such as an angular momentum conserving Hadley cell. Instead, you have to get such a jet from an upgradient momentum transport by waves or turbulence. And Rossby waves are a classic candidate. So Rossby waves are the most important type of wave that shapes the atmospheric circulation of the Earth. There are many types of waves. There's acoustic waves, which for the Earth are almost irrelevant for the meteorology. There are buoyancy waves, called gravity waves in the atmospheric literature, which are somewhat important, especially in the upper atmosphere. And Rossby waves are the dominant one. Rossby waves are essentially vorticity waves, which result from this beta term that I alluded to earlier, the gradient of the strength of the Coriolis force with latitude. And basically what that implies is that if you take a fluid parcel at some latitude and you shove it north or south, it will spin up or spin down in such a way that it produces a secondary circulation that it pushes it back to the same latitude where it started. So it acts as a restoring force and causes an oscillation, and you get a wave out of that. And so it's known that Rossby waves are a dominant mechanism for producing the jet stream on Earth. It turns out that if you generate Rossby waves in a certain latitude band and radiate them away from there, you naturally get eastward acceleration due to eddies, essentially due to the convergence of the Reynolds stress. You get eastward acceleration where the Rossby waves are generated and westward acceleration where they dissipate or break. So for very simple analytic solutions for Rossby waves, you can actually show this analytically. And so this has been suggested as the standard mechanism for the so-called eddy-driven jet on the Earth, which is that we have baroclinic instabilities in the mid-latitudes. The temperature and entropy gradients are very strong in the mid-latitudes, especially near the surface. That's baroclinically unstable. So there's, large sort of, blobs of fluid that kind of move upward while moving poleward and downward while moving equatorward with a length scale of this deformation radius that I was alluding to. And this process causes wiggles in the atmospheric flow that leads to the radiation of Rossby waves away from that latitude. And as a result, there's an acceleration there, which is why we have a jet in the mid-latitudes. And that may well be a mechanism for producing the jets on Jupiter, too. For a hot Jupiter, the baroclinic instabilities may not be so relevant, but instead we have this monstrous day-night forcing. The day-night forcing can also effectively cause wiggles that essentially is a natural generator of planetary-scale Rossby waves, and it could be that this could also cause the equatorial superrotation. So testing this is one of the things that I've been doing over the past 6 months or so. I'm going to show a few results from that right now. So I showed you some full three-dimensional general circulation models, some of which include detailed radiative transfer. And even when they don't, they include a wide range of physical things all going on simultaneously. For those who've worked on such models, you'll know that it's actually very hard to figure out what's causing what in a nonlinear model like that. It's not like some linear calculation where A goes to B goes to C in some straightforward manner. It's in order to diagnose and identify a specific mechanism, it's useful to go to very simplified models, to consider a whole hierarchy of models, starting with the simplest. So what I've done is to start with a very, very simple model, which I think is sort of the minimal model of this phenomenon to show how it works. Essentially, what one needs to generate superrotation is to tilt the velocity, eddy velocities, in this type of manner. So suppose that you have, these sort of Rossby waves that are radiated away from the equator, let's say, then if you what that will do is it will produce velocity tilts where when blobs of fluid are moving equatorward, they're moving eastward faster than average, and when they're moving poleward, they're moving westward faster than average. So that there will be a Reynolds stress associated with this. If U is the eastward component and V is the northward component, then U, the longitudinal average of UV, U times V, will be negative, so it'll be an equatorward flux of momentum. In the other hemisphere, it will have the opposite sign. U, zonal average of UV, will be positive. So in both cases, you'll get an equatorward flux of eastward eddy momentum, indicated here by these little dashed lines, and superrotation will be the result. So this is really what you need, and then Rossby waves is just one mechanism for doing that. Okay, so I'm going to start with the simplest model, like I said, is the so-called shallow water equations for a single fluid layer. So V here is the horizontal velocity, and we're thinking about a layer of constant density fluid which has a variable thickness, which is H, and that layer is floating on a quiescent deep interior that represents the deep interior of the gas giant. And if that deep interior, you can treat that as a full two-layer model, and if the deep interior is assumed to be quiescent, and it's assumed to be infinitely deep, and has no dynamics, then that system, it turns out, collapses to this set of equations just for the flow in the top layer. And so V here is the velocity in the top layer, H is the thickness of the top layer, this is the Coriolis force. I've added a drag here, which just is a very crude parameterization of drag. So alpha is a drag coefficient. This negative sign indicates that you are relaxing the wind speed towards zero over a time constant of 1 over alpha. This term is a vertical advection term associated with vertical advection of momentum that follows directly from the momentum budget. Without it, you would not have a consistent momentum budget. I should say that this gradient is only the horizontal gradient. So this is how the vertical component is represented. This is the continuity equation. So changes in the local thickness of the fluid occur when there's a flux of mass into or out of a column. And you should think of this model as a representation of the upper part of the atmosphere and the boundary between this modeled layer and this infinitely deep lower part of the atmosphere is essentially an isentrope. And so in a model like this, when you have heating or cooling, you don't represent that with a change in the temperature or heating in terms of a temperature tendency. Instead, it's represented as a mass source or a mass sink. Because what heating does is it increases or decreases the entropy of the air. And if the bounding surface is an isentrope, then if you cause heating, what that does is it takes air from the low entropy deep interior and it moves it into the high entropy stratified atmosphere. So that would be a source of mass. And where cooling occurs would be a sink of mass. So that's how you do heating in any model where entropy is a vertical coordinate. And so I've represented that with just a very simple relaxation of the wind of the height field toward a radiative equilibrium height field, H eq, which is thick on the day side and thin on the night side, representing hot on the day side and cold on the night side. Gamma is 1 over the radiative time constant. So first I'm going to consider linear, steady, analytic solutions, and then I'm going to consider full nonlinear solutions on a sphere. So if you take this set of equations and then linearize them about a state of rest, and then you just impose steady forcing, so H eq is just constant and does not depend on time. This problem actually has is a well-defined name in the Earth dynamics community. It's called the Matsuno-Gill problem. So Matsuno first studied this problem in 1966, and Gill studied this in a classic paper published in 1980. And this provides much of the cornerstone for modern tropical dynamics in the Earth atmosphere. For example, this provided some of the very early ideas for how the monsoons work and how the so-called Walker circulation operates in the Earth's tropics. And essentially what I'm doing is extending this to the exoplanet case. Even these Earth guys never considered the implications for superrotation because the Earth is not currently superrotating in the troposphere. But these are sort of natural extensions that, even though they're only being done now, could well have been done two decades ago. Okay, so what I'm doing here is, here's the forcing. This is HE. So this represents the day side, substellar point, antistellar points over here. This analytic calculation is actually in a Cartesian geometry, but this would it's periodic in this direction, and this would represent one planetary circumference. So this, again, it's a two-parameter problem. You have these two coefficients, the drag coefficient and the thermal damping coefficient. And so if you choose values for those, then you can get a solution. And this shows solutions for sort of hot Jupiter-like values of one day. So what's being shown on here is the color is the solution for the thickness, and the arrows show the solution for the eddy wind. And you can see that there's a lot of dynamical structure. The flow for this solution does not follow the radiative equilibrium. And it turns out that if you look at it, there's sort of two classes of behavior. So along the equator, there is eddy flow that is eastward away from the substellar point and westward to the west of the substellar point, so sort of diverging along the equator. And then at high latitudes, there's more of a vortical type motion. There's a structure where the winds are kind of circulating around these, the height contours, and it behaves more like a vortex. And it turns out that even though this is a perfectly steady solution, that this is dynamically analogous to two fundamental modes of behavior in Earth atmospheric dynamics, which is the Kelvin wave and the equatorially trapped Rossby wave. So there's a whole class of equatorially trapped waves in Earth atmospheric dynamics. And the Kelvin wave is one that has very weak north-south motions and has a particular force balance in the north-south direction and propagates to the east. And these equatorially trapped Rossby waves have kind of high centers of pressure and or temperature off of the equator, and they tend to have circulation around those along with a component of circulation at the equator, and they propagate westward. So this model is, the mathematics here is essentially identical to those two modes of behavior. Now you can see from looking at this that we indeed get the kind of phase tilt that we need. It looks like a chevron centered at the equator and pointing east, such that you would have a Reynolds stress that would pump momentum to the equator. Even though this is a steady linear solution, you can say, well, what would happen if it were nonlinear? If we did this at finite amplitude in a nonlinear calculation, this would imply that you would have a momentum flux to the equator. And so just from this linear calculation, we could diagnose what those momentum fluxes would be. And you could write down an equation, which I've just written a part of here at the bottom, for the zonal, U bar is the zonal mean zonal wind. So we have the rate of change of time of the zonal mean zonal wind is a bunch of terms that are basically the divergence of the Reynolds stress, right? So we have, and this term here is the latitudinal convergence of the latitudinal momentum flux. So this plot shows the calculation from this analytic solution. In black shows this first term. So this is the acceleration due to the convergence in the horizontal. And then the blue shows the convergence in the vertical. There's a convergence in the vertical, even in the simple model, because of the mass flow in and out of the system. So the fluid is trading mass with the underlying quiescent layer, and it's also trading angular momentum and energy with that layer. And it turns out that that term resists at the equator. That term causes a westward acceleration at the equator. And so we have these two terms, an eastward acceleration at the equator due to the horizontal convergence, a westward acceleration due to the vertical convergence. You can actually show analytically, you can even prove it in a very general case, but specifically in this calculation, you can see that the eastward acceleration due to the horizontal term actually dominates over the westward one. And as a result, the net effect, the sum of all the terms, is this red curve, and would hence like to cause an eastward superrotation, eastward jet at the equator, and westward flow in the mid to high latitudes, which is exactly what we have in the hot Jupiter models. This is just steady, like I said, and we're only linearized around a state of rest here. So one then would like to take it to the nonlinear case. So then what we did is I solved the exact same set of equations, these so-called shallow water equations, but I kept the full nonlinearities, and I did it properly in spherical geometry. So it's on a sphere now, but it's still this fairly idealized model. To make a bridge with this analytic calculation, I started actually by doing it at very, very low amplitude. So even though the dynamical model itself includes all the linearities, all the non-linearities, if you tune the amplitude, if you do a numerical run with a very, very tiny amplitude, it's essentially a linear run. And so first I did that to compare with this behavior. And you can see this shows some results from that. So again, in full spherical geometry, longitude, latitude, equator, south pole, and north pole, for very similar values of the time constant. And you can see a similar type of behavior. You get the chevron-like pattern. You have these Rossby wave lobes here. If I'd plotted the winds, you would see a divergence away from this point just in the same manner. And the steady state zonal mean zonal wind that you get, in other words, longitudinally averaged east-west wind, is shown here. Zero is there, so we're getting eastward flow at the equator and westward flow in the mid-latitudes. And I should also mention what the dynamical mechanism is. I mentioned that there's these wave modes, but what's the dynamical mechanism for causing the chevron? That's really the key question, because that's what's causing the flux of momentum to the equator that gives you the superrotation. And the mechanism is actually a bit different than what is commonly alluded to in the Earth mid-latitude literature. And it has to do with the fact that essentially there is a group propagation of the Kelvin waves to the east and a group propagation of these Rossby waves to the west. And that's what's causing this. So essentially there's a flux of energy to the east due to the Kelvin waves, to the west due to the Rossby waves. And so if you just think about, taking a high that's centered around the substellar point and pushing it to the east at the equator and to the west at these mid-latitudes, you're going to naturally produce this type of a chevron pattern. And the winds tend to follow that chevron not too differently. The winds are relatively close to parallel to that if the friction is not too strong. So that's the basic dynamical mechanism, is this differential zonal propagation of these different wave modes as a function of latitude. Kelvin waves do, they have eastward propagation in the Earth's atmosphere. The speed of the Kelvin wave propagation in this limit is three times that of the Rossby wave propagation. But yeah, the Coriolis force is very important for the Kelvin wave. It's a gravity wave in the east-west direction, and it's geostrophically balanced in the north-south direction, and that's how the Coriolis force enters its dynamics. And so in a Kelvin wave, if I drew it by itself without the Rossby wave component, if this was the equator, you'd have like a high and a low. And so the pressure gradient force that's pushing out like in this manner is not balanced by any Coriolis force in the east-west direction, and instead it's just compensated by or balanced by the time-dependent term. So it's gravity wave-like dynamics this way. And in this direction, in north-south direction, there's a Coriolis force on the wind that then is balancing the pressure gradient force. And it turns out that that dynamics leads to an eastward propagation. Okay, so again, this is full spherical geometry but low amplitude. Now let's jack it up to the hot Jupiter-type amplitude. And so same qualitative type of behavior, you still get the chevron pattern. Here's the zonal mean, zonal wind, so we're getting up pretty fast to sort of Jupiter-like parameters, kind of a kilometer a second. And you can actually do lots of diagnostics on these calculations exactly the same way I showed for the analytic calculation. This color scheme is the same, so black is the acceleration due to the horizontal eddy momentum convergence, blue is that due to the vertical eddy momentum convergence, and you can see that they also counteract. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that the black curve always wins, that the black curve is greater at the equator than the blue curve. That's true because this is not an equilibrium state. This is not in the full nonlinear case, the fluid would accelerate off of this. So it would be a net eastward acceleration that's going to generate the superrotation. And the way the steady state is achieved, if the friction's high, then the friction enters the force balance, and you can equilibrate that way. If the friction is low, then what happens is there's a back reaction on the eddies from the zonal jets, and that forces these two to change until they're equal. And so this model, which is in steady state, has equilibrated so that finally, now that once you get this gigantic jet, now these become equal and the jet stops accelerating. Okay, so now what's the connection between these and the full 3D models? So now let me take the original 3D model that I showed that was coupled to radiator transfer, and let's look at the very early phases before spin-up has occurred. So this is just a day into the integration, which is long enough that we've had time for the circulation to pump these global sort of quasi-linear wave modes, but before those modes have had time to produce an equatorial jet. And you can see the behavior just staring you in the face, that you have this divergence away from the region along the equator here into the substellar longitude. That's the standing Kelvin wave behavior. You have this Rossby wave type behavior, in this case affected somewhat by advection because it's a very high amplitude version of that case. But it's the same, just the same dynamics. And this is the model from my 2009 paper. And if you go back and look at some of the older literature as well, it's the same thing. This is a snapshot at early times from this run that I published in 2002. And you can see this Kelvin wave-like emanation away from this point along the equator and this Rossby wave-like structure here at the higher latitudes. And then, of course, once this spins up into a steady state, then that changes the structure of these jets. So at that point, the connection or the qualitative appearance with the analytic calculation is a little bit less extreme. Okay, one can do lots of diagnostics, which maybe I'll skip. Let me just mention what happens if you change the parameters. You can imagine varying the rotation rate, varying the orbital distance. This is showing the zonal mean zonal winds, so the longitudinally averaged east-west winds, with red being eastward and blue being zero or westward. And it's shown versus latitude. Every one of these plots is like this. Every one of these plots is latitude on the x-axis and pressure on the y-axis. So the equator is in the center, and then very deep is at the bottom, and up high in the atmosphere is at the top of each plot. And each plot is a different numerical integration for different parameters, where, you know, this is fast, going this way is faster rotation rate, and going this way is increasing orbital distance. This particular run in the bottom center is the run that I showed you before. And so what happens is that, so in this case, the day-night forcing is dominant, and you do not have this mid-latitude forcing that Earth has. You do not have this radiation of Rossby waves from mid-latitudes. It's all equator-dominated. It's equatorial wave forcing, so you're dominated by one super-rotating jet with westward flow in the mid-lats. When you jack up the rotation rate, or you make the radiative time constant weaker, then you increase the equator to pole temperature difference, and you're essentially weakening the strength of the tropical day-night forcing and strengthening the forcing associated with the equator to pole temperature difference. And as a result, you start getting mid-latitude jets. So here you're getting these instabilities in mid-latitudes. Rossby waves are then radiating away from the mid-latitudes, and so you start to get eastward jets in the mid-latitudes. And some parameter regimes, they actually coexist with a super-rotation at the equator. And then if you push it to highly rapidly rotating, so this is like a Jupiter rotation rate at an increasing distance, you hardly even have an equatorial jet, and you're getting multiple jets instead in each hemisphere in the mid-latitudes. So you can imagine if you just go a bit further, then you would have Jupiter with kind of 10 jets in each hemisphere. Okay, so that's basically it. You can look at the temperature patterns from this. The intense radiation on a hot Jupiter produces winds of order a kilometer a second and temperature contrasts that vary widely with the parameters, but it can be kind of 200 to 1,000 K for the parameters that we've been looking at. The winds distort the temperature pattern in a complex manner, which has important implications for light curves and spectra. For synchronously rotating planets, our models, as well as those of almost all the other groups, produce equatorial superrotation under appropriate conditions, namely when the dynamical and advection times are comparable. This can displace the hottest regions to the east of the substellar point. And what I've shown here is that this results from an upgradient wave transport because of standing Rossby and Kelvin waves that are triggered by this longitudinal day-night heating variation. We demonstrated this mechanism cleanly in a sequence of simple models, and the consistency of the picture that emerges from a wide range of model complexities is, I think, encouraging and suggests the mechanism is quite robust. And lastly, there's a regime shift from this super-rotating dominated regime to a more Earth-like mid-latitude jet regime as you change the rotation rate or the radiative time constant. And so this is just the tip of the iceberg for what's going to be done. You know, there's all sorts of interesting climate questions that I alluded to at the beginning, and I'll stop there. Thank you.